Welcome back to Destination USA from Index Ventures. This is the last episode in our series that explored how Europe's leading entrepreneurs and operators expanded their businesses to the US. At Index, we've supported over 40 companies with their US expansion, and we published a definitive guide on this topic, which you can check out on our website.
This is not a world where you can, you know, be without an element of dynamism and constant pushing the boundaries and constantly, you know, asking yourself, could we go faster?
This week, Index partner Danny Reimer speaks with Farfetch founder José Neves. Farfetch is the world's biggest online marketplace for independent fashion boutiques. José founded Farfetch in Porto and London in 2007 and listed on the New York Stock Exchange in 2018.
You know, the two biggest markets are US and China. So if you are going to win, you need to win in these two markets.
Danny and José discuss Farfetch and its global journey, what Formula One has in common with entrepreneurship, and entering the US via a partnership. Happy listening.
Well, José, thank you very much for being here. It's such
a pleasure, Danny,
to chat with you. I've missed seeing you on a more frequent basis, so this is a great excuse for a catch-up.
Yeah, totally. I missed you too. It's been a few, you know, weeks or months, and but we were almost on a daily basis talking, and yes, it's good. It's good to catch up.
Well, listen, there are a bunch of themes that I wanted to cover that I think would be really helpful for entrepreneurs during this hour. Part of it is based on the US, but also part of it is your entrepreneurial trajectory. And, you know, I often talk about when I talk to entrepreneurs who are starting out, obviously you're a role model that a lot of them ask about. And when they ask me sort of what are some of the things that you've learned from José, part of what I try to describe since witnessing it since the early days in 2011 is this combination that you have of being very patient, but also driving incredibly hard at the same time. And so what I talk to entrepreneurs about is, it's almost as though, imagine someone who had the accelerator and the brake on at the same time. And they're just throttling between the two of them constantly in order to really grow the business based on the vision that they've had. And so I wanted you to talk about that. Like, first of all, do you agree that it's a constant management of patience and acceleration? And second of all, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great metaphor, actually. And I was, as you were painting that picture, I was imagining, you know, like Formula One driver. That's what they do, isn't it? Like, they're constantly on both paddles. And I think it starts with a long-term vision, though. I think you really need that. You really need to have, I call it the purpose of Farfetch. I always say it's for the love of fashion and revolutionary technology. So that element of love for an industry and feeling that you can be a positive force in the long term in shaping a part of culture. In the case of Farfetch, fashion is part of culture. I know you spoke to Daniel Ek. I think it's the same thing with Spotify, like shaping the future of music, such an amazing part of human culture, is probably the driver as well. So I think it starts with that, right? And then once you have that, I think you do need to love working in environments that are at speed, right? So the internet works at lightning speed, and you do need to have that DNA, right? Because this is not a world where you can, you know, be without an element of dynamism and constant, you know, pushing the boundaries and constantly, you know, asking yourself, could we go faster? And it's not just going fast for the sake of going fast, it's for the sake of fulfilling your mission. Because if you are going to revolutionize an entire industry, time is of the essence, right? So there's a certain timing when things work and there's a timing when things don't work anymore. And you have to have that sense of urgency in a way. So I think that's the combination in our case, at least.
And were there times along the way, because honestly, José, I did not see them, when you had some, you certainly hit it for me if you felt it, where you had some doubts as to whether Farfetch was going to win?
Yes, I never had a fundamental doubt. That's true. I think that is, you know, for the better or the worse, is something entrepreneurs need to have. And continuing with the analogy of the Formula One driver, they can't think too much about the car crash, can they? I mean, if they they have no time, right? And I think if they had that in their driving, they wouldn't be great drivers because they would be constantly not in the moment. They would be creating mental movies, right? So I think, you know, entrepreneurs have that psychological trick. I think it's a brain trick. It's a trick our brains come up with, which where you have a completely skewed vision of risk and reward, right? It's, you know, I normally speak with investors like you, and I don't know, you know, in our conversations, I, you know, probably said this more than once. It's like, I'm running a portfolio of one, right? And therefore, you do need to have this, it's almost a psychological trick. It's not a trick because you can help it, right? But it is a trick in the sense that you do not perceive the risks that others are perceiving, but you do perceive opportunities where others also cannot perceive them. And that, I think, is an element that needs to exist if you're going to be a successful entrepreneur, because the odds when, you know, from the start, from day one, you know, the odds are statistically not in your favor, right? So you do need this disproportionate belief in what your company can do, what your mission is, and what your team can do and achieve. And that's what keeps us going.
One of the things that Daniel brought up was that actually it turned out that because he was challenged when he could enter the US by doubling down on Sweden and Europe, it turned out to be a boon for him because they were then much more prepared when they entered the US and they had a much better example case study to show the labels in his case. Your story is very different. From day one, in fact, before we even invested, you had already understood the value of the US and had done a partnership. Can you talk to us about how you thought about it?
Yes, I think, you know, there is an element of the DNA of Farfetch. One of our values is to think global. So we're constantly thinking the entire world. We never think, you know, on a region by region basis. And there's another element, which is the industry we're in. And luxury, you know, the two biggest markets are US and China, right? So if you are going to win, you need to win in these two markets. And also, especially if you're running a marketplace, so you have a two-side marketplace, so you have brands, ultimately, on one side, retailers, but obviously the retailers need the brand support. So you have brands on one side, you have consumers on the other side. What's strategically powerful for the brands is if you can bring them brand awareness and customers in territories where necessarily they're not very proficient at operating in. And the brands are European for the most part. In luxury, it's 85% of the luxury supply comes from Europe. So for us to succeed in the two non-European largest markets was paramount to this vision of a global platform for luxury. So we took big bets, big risks. And as you know, it was a bit of a clunky setup because we were just a tiny startup. We were, you know, 2009, we're just 1 year down the line. We did a joint venture with Revolve, actually, and they're still good friends today. They're a listed company on their own now. And it was done in a very entrepreneurial way and in a very, you know, not very, in a very structured way. As you know, I had to correct the structure before you guys could invest. And you were totally right. But that shows how clear it was for us that, you know, by hook or by crook, we had to enter the U.S. And the other thing is US VCs. I was acutely aware that if we proved our model right in Europe, very quickly there could be a copycat that would be funded and potentially much, much more aggressively than us in US and would then corner that market. So there was a number of things. But I think, you know, at the end is also the vision for the company, right? So we always wanted Farfetch to be a global business from day one. I think this is an advantage that Swedish companies have, and I guess Portuguese ones as well. Like, we're from tiny little countries of 10 million people. Coincidentally, it's kind of the same population in both. So we grow up knowing that we will have to learn another language and we will have to trade. We need to trade with our other countries. We can't survive on our own. So this This also, I think, creates in the teams that mentality that this is never going to be just about Europe. This is always going to be about more than that. And because I still think that, you know, if you go too late, if companies go international too late, and you are much better positioned than me to judge on that. But if they go too late, then everything becomes a difficulty, because then you're too big and you're looking at the market like China and say, how the heck do I tackle this? It's just a black hole in the map. And how do I go about this? And then by then you're too big, too many employees, too many expectations. If you're a public company, then it's even harder. So I think you need to do it when you're private, and you need to do it as early as possible.
Yes, and I would definitely say that you're always mindful of resources and risk. On the other hand, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you had a ton of experience going in, working in the US or in China before you entered those markets. And you signed up partnerships that were pretty extensive. And, you know, it feels like you were willing to take the risk, even though you knew that it might not be the right partner and you might have to learn and change courses pretty substantially, which is amazing to me, actually.
Totally, yeah. That's also the DNA of the company. We see ourselves as partners to an industry and enablers, the digital enablers of an entire industry. So we tend to see people as partners. Just intuitively, right? So we tend to see them as partners. And to your point, I think we see the benefits of partnering, even with the risks that any partnership involves. They trump, you know, the problems when you don't partner with exactly the right partner and you need to switch. I mean, in China, you know, we tried with JD, both parties tried in good faith, and it didn't work to the extent that both parties wanted it to work. And now we've done a new partnership with Alibaba. So I think, well, if you ask me which partner would have you picked, that's theoretical. But I would still have, I don't think it was necessarily a bad thing. I still think that we did the right thing and it was important for us to learn. I think the corollary is that you don't learn if you don't try. If you're not in market, if you don't try things, you'll never learn. And then you'll, after a few years, you'll look at that market and it will seem daunting, much more daunting than if you had dipped in the water and tried for a few years.
Right. But it sounds like you also, and maybe you're not saying this, that it depends on the industry that you're in. So it doesn't sound like you're saying, or maybe you are saying, that regardless of the industry that you were going after, if you had the same passion, you'd still try to go global very quickly rather than, you know, methodically conquer one country, conquer one continent before entering another. Is that fair to say?
Totally. I agree with you. I think it is not the same approach for every company. For example, in China, I have a very clear rule. I mean, I'm in the e-commerce marketplace industry. The rest, I don't know. But in terms of e-commerce or even music platforms, two-side or even, you know, like two-side marketplaces, let's put it this way, two-side platforms. My rule of thumb is don't enter China if you don't have a supply advantage. So if you don't have something that the Chinese local competitor cannot replicate, just don't even bother. And the problem with Uber, for example, is that there's no supply advantage. So they have to recruit drivers and they have to recruit customers. Same thing with food delivery, the same thing with other industries. In our case, we have the supply they cannot replicate. I think Airbnb is another good example. Airbnb has a supply that no Chinese company, Ctrip, cannot just go and sign up hundreds of thousands of landlords in hundreds of countries. They just won't do that, will they? So that gives Airbnb the supply advantage, which is unsurmountable for any Chinese local player, which means that your competition at the end of the day will ultimately be Western companies also trying to enter China, or local competitors that team up or somehow get access to that supply, right? So for us, because we have the supply advantage, it makes sense to be a little bit intrepid and go into these territories. But I would, you know, if an entrepreneur would come to me and say, that would be my rule of my acid test, is that what is your supply advantage? Because local players will win. They are better at their local technology. They're better at their local acquisition, customer acquisition, or seller acquisition. They'll get more funding. They'll reach valuations, higher valuations faster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't compete with them.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me. It feels like it's very difficult to build a marketplace if you don't have scarce supply under your belt at first. It feels like, you know, demand optimization over time makes a lot of sense. And certainly, you know, we should talk about gross marketing in your case and how strategic you were about thinking about that well ahead of the curve. But it felt like supply was absolutely the first thing you went after.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in our case, it's a delicate exercise because it's not about liquidity and volume. It's not about bringing volume to luxury brands. They have the volume. They you know, they can control their growth. As we saw, even through the pandemic, if you look at how luxury stocks have performed, you know, they have so many levers to pull, right? Their sales go down in Europe, they go up in China. So they're not interested in just another channel. They're interested in people that can add value to their generational, because these are generational businesses, these are family businesses, right? And to the generational buildup of brand equity. That's what they need to feel. They need to feel that you're in the journey with them to build value over 10, 15, 20 years. And so it is harder than just getting supply maybe in some other, you know, industries where you prove that you can shift merchandise and that's it, you got a seller. But yeah, I totally agree with you.
And Jose, another aspect that's really unique to Farfetch is the different cultures that you've had to integrate over time to make Farfetch a truly global business, starting obviously with the Portuguese roots that are still, you know, I don't know what percentage of the headcount is still in Porto and Lisbon, half, right?
Around half, yeah.
But then on the other hand, you never saw it completely as a Portuguese company, right?
Yeah, totally. When we did the IPO in the New York Stock Exchange, I had the Portuguese flag and the British flag. And the American flag, but the American flag is always there. And that was a moment, right? It was the first time a Portuguese company, Portuguese-British company, you know, listed in the New York Stock Exchange with an IPO. And, you know, it's very much part of the DNA, but it was global from day one. Like in London, we have, 25 nationalities in our office. This was always a British-Portuguese company, so we always had offices, as you know, in both places. And so there was this feeling of being global from day one. But yeah, I think we just leveraged the best characteristics of each culture, right? And it's interesting because, you know, Portuguese, they're more silent, but they're deeper. You know, they like to go into the detail and they have very deep thinking and they mull over a problem for ages. It's just part of the DNA of the country. But other cultures have other characteristics. You know, the Brits are great with pop culture, and they look at you know, successes in so many areas of culture. Therefore, in terms of marketing, brand positioning, having that instinct for the brand and the customer is definitely something that London has in droves. So it's really, you know, trying to leverage what's the best that we can take from these cultures and make them work seamlessly together.
Yeah, I remember, though, that the value that seemed to be appreciated across the entire organization the most was Todos Juntos.
Totally, yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying it correctly, but it's something like that.
No, it's Todos Juntos, which means all together. It's interesting, the story of that value. So we have six values: be human, Todos Juntos, think global, be revolutionary, amaze customers, and be brilliant. And Todos Juntos actually was the idea of a British guy that was in that group and said, listen, one of the values should be Portuguese because half of the company is Portuguese. It's not fair that all the values are written in English. So why not? And that's a nice little quirk. And it's nice when people go to job interviews and say, what is this? You know, and we explain where it came from. And yeah, but I think, you know, it's interesting because when you look at our values, the ones that come out consistently is be human and Todos Juntos. And it's interesting because they're the ones that speak most to teamwork and team spirit and, you know, partnership and the love for an industry, right? So there's these very soft values because others arguably like amaze customers or be brilliant. They're more left brain, right? They're more like get shit done kind of value. But the others are softer. And it's interesting when you go and do surveys and et cetera, the ones that people relate more are the softer values.
the amount of time that you spend on culture and think about it across offices, given all the other stuff that you also have on your plate, is really impressive. Like, is that something that is just, it's part of your genetic makeup? It's probably true, but it's also something that I think you find super important.
Yeah, totally. I think COVID-19 is a great example. When the crisis hit, you were at the board of the company, so you know this very well. No one knew what was going to happen. We didn't know if demand was going to be there. We didn't know if supply was going to be there, if the boutiques could even deliver, or Italy was entering into a lockdown, if the factories would even produce any goods. So it was a moment of huge uncertainty. But what galvanized the team was a sense of mission and culture and values. And we got together and we launched the hashtag support boutiques in April. We got galvanized. We said, listen, we can't save lives, that's not our role, but we can save businesses. As a platform, we can save businesses. And these businesses, the vast majority, they're family-owned, they're local businesses. There's tens of thousands of jobs that are involved here, thousands of designers. We have 3,500 designers represented on the platform.
Yeah, and the other thing that's really interesting to see is that obviously, you know, when you started off and when I met you, the boutiques were the be-all, end-all, right? And you were trying to demonstrate your relevance to them, and were even building websites because they were convinced that they were going to be able to drive traffic, and who is Farfetch? And now you're a core, if not the main core way that they're able to actually thrive. So has that changed the way that you perceive the industry or the way that you interact with these boutiques? Or are there certain values that you just feel like, look, we were, you always said, for the love of fashion. So is that sort of sacrosanct? You're not going to change the way that you act towards the boutiques, regardless of how relevant you become.
Totally. It is sacrosanct. And again, through the COVID pandemic, there could be other approaches, right? There was no, you know, obligation for us to stop everything that we're doing. We could have done other things, right? But for us, the sense that we had to go back where we started, which we started in the humble, you know, beginning with 25 boutiques in the marketplace, that was, you know, we had to do that. We just knew we had to do that. And we continued to engage with them in the same respectful manner that we always did.
An area that I wanted to cover as well is partnerships. So partnerships on the geographic standpoint, but partnerships also from a strategic standpoint. Obviously, you know, as the company has changed, the role that you have with partnership has changed, where before you were probably really asking a lot for partnerships and you were evaluating and thinking through how you could get this larger brand or entity to partner with you. And now you're the big player. How do you think of that? And have you had to change your mindset when thinking about partnerships?
Well, first of all, we're not a big player. That's what's exciting, right? Because we're, 3 billion net sales in 2020. That's 1% of the industry, of a 300 billion industry. And we are playing in all these markets. So it is actually the total TAM we could address. We're playing in all these opportunities successfully. So we're small, and that's exciting, because for me, the glass is half full, and there's so much to do. And then I think it's really, you know, how for me, partnerships have to be win-win. And I'm not a very tough negotiator. I always, come with a fair, what I think is something that could be a win-win for both parties involved. And I understand that if it's not a win-win, even if you get a deal done, you know, it's a, how they call it, a Pyrrhic victory, isn't it? Because quickly, you'll find out that it's not going to go very far. So for me, you know, independently of our size, I mean, the deals we've done recently, the companies are, you know, 20, 30 times bigger than us, right? In the case of Alibaba, even in the case of the luxury groups, they're much larger than us. So we're still in the comfortable position. For us, it's comfortable of being the small guy in the room.
You know, one of the things that I have reflected on with respect to the way that you've run Farfetch is I always viewed, you know, there's only a certain number of partnerships that you can do because it's a distraction from the core. And as you just pointed it out, you know, you've seen it. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but in some ways, a partnership is the beginning. And then I'm going to see whether it works out or not. But you don't view that every partnership that you do per se is going to be successful, or you have to do everything you can to make it successful. Is that right?
Yeah, I think a partnership is a relationship, and you start it in good faith, and you start it from a position of this is a win-win and every party is going to benefit. It should move the needle somehow, because otherwise, I agree with you, then we're just distracting to what's the main cause. But yeah, you know, some will work and some won't work, and that's I think you need to have that approach and not be too frustrated when they don't work, or too attached, because that's the other thing. Sometimes you're so attached that you're the sunken cost that you've put in there. It keeps you going and going and going when it's, you know what, let's cut this short, which is the best for everyone involved. I think, you know, I do think that, you know, there is different DNAs of different companies. And I always used to, you know, be a difficult CEO to manage, as you know, because you have the Amazon approach and you have the eBay approach, right? And the eBay approach is let's do one thing very, very, very well and optimize it. And the Amazon approach, let's do 650 things very, very well and go for the big prize and with a very long-term 10, 20-year vision. And we're more on the Amazon camp, you know. We're not a company that is going to sit and say, you know what, this is such a big opportunity in these three territories and in these three categories, and let's just stick to this. This is where our comfort zone is. And I don't think there's a right or wrong here, really. I don't think, because there's no right or wrong, because you could be... You can make Farfetch multiple times the market cap we are today by focusing, or you can make it a multiple times the market cap it is today by, which I still call focus, but by a more ambitious, overarching strategy. So I just think it's a matter of philosophy, and it has to do with the founder and the CEO. I don't think, you know, certain founders will be the optimizing founder, and others will be always the explorer founders. So it's the two types of founders.
Yeah. And I want to make sure that the listeners know that what José just described as the Amazon strategy for the way that he runs it is not a new concept, but something that he clarified a long time ago. And there was, you know, that, I mean, there was definitely pushback, which probably was very frustrating to you from the board on, you know, you always came with like, hey guys, I have 10 other ideas that I want to push on as well. And we're like, oh my God, the core is working so well. Like, does this guy ever sleep or, you know, how
yes,
many?
No.
But no, what I was going to ask you was, is that pushback, you think that, I mean, you think that pushback was helpful, or was it bloody frustrating, and actually, you know, we should have just said, okay, keep on bringing these ideas. Let's go with it.
No, I think the board needs to do the board's role, and the board's role is to kick the tires and to question the reasoning of the entrepreneur. That is very helpful, because we all have blind spots. I have huge blind spots, and again, it's the benefit of relationships, isn't it? You evolve so much faster if you have someone that is honest with you and tells it as it is, well, as they think it is, right? I think, you know, it's then the trust element is the crucial factor, where the board kicks the tires and then says, you know what, okay, so we're content with, okay, this is not just something that came out of nowhere, right? Okay, this is... You know, there is some kind of, you know, strong rationale and case and instinct, right? The instinct is in the right place. So it's not driven by megalomania or ego or you know, like when things go well, you know, all of human beings are like that. When things go well, we all, you know, go, our egos inflate a little bit and then reality deflates them. And so the board helps entrepreneurs go through those cycles, which are normal. But then I think a good board ultimately trusts the entrepreneur, and a good entrepreneur trusts the board, and in some cases will say, you know what, you guys are right. So this is let's just park this, which also happened in our case multiple times. There were times I say, you know what, like just yeah, absolutely, thank you. So yeah, but ultimately I don't think that you can take a company that wants to conquer the world and really change an entire industry, an entire category, and retrofit that company to be an optimizer. That's not going to work. Or the other way around. You cannot take a company that is very content with a certain thing and say, well, you guys should do this and that. It's just not in their DNA. So, and that's why VCs exist, right? VCs exist because this is not linear. This stuff is not easy. It's far from easy. And there's a lot of left brain, right brain activity involved here and ping-ponging. And that's where you guys are excellent at it.
Well, thank you. I mean, the other thing that I would say is what's been amazing is your ability to not be emotionally attached to something, even with the sunken cost, which I think fundamentally is so hard for anyone to do. Like it's hard for me to do. It's even playing a portfolio play, as you said, you have a portfolio of one and you still didn't stick to the emotional side of it.
Yeah, I think distance is a good word. It is, you do need to understand your emotions and they're there for a reason and respect them and give them space. But understand that at the end of the day, they are bits of information. Emotions are just bits of information. And then you need to take time to let them do their work and then evolve because, you know, they evolve. They go from, I don't know, from anger to frustration, from frustration to clarity, from clarity actually to something great, right? So it's to hope, I don't know, something like that. So there's an evolution in emotions. But that detachment of saying, okay, what's going on here? And we're not just going to act out on the first one that comes. Let them ferment and do what they're supposed to do, which and play with each other and let's see what comes out, what picture comes out of it. So giving that space for emotions to not suppress them, but live with them and not act on them, I think it's very important. And then comes out that they're very helpful. And in the end, with a dose of humility and listening capability and trust with your partners and team, etc., you're probably gonna hit it right most of the time.
That's right.
José, what a pleasure. Such a pleasure to catch up with you.
Thank you so much, Danny. It's always, so great to chat with you. And thank you for including us in this initiative.
Thanks for listening to Destination USA from our team here at Index Ventures. We hope you enjoyed the series. Over the course of 8 episodes, we introduced you to Europe's leading entrepreneurs and operators who took on one of the ultimate business challenges, expanding to the US. We went behind the scenes with Spotify, Farfetch, Adyen, and others to discuss hiring, branding, company culture, and so much more. If you missed any of the episodes, you can have a listen wherever you get your podcasts. Index Ventures is a transatlantic venture capital firm that has supported more than 40 European tech companies with their US expansions. We've also created an in-depth playbook for US expansion based on our experiences and extensive research. So if you want more, please do check it out. Thanks for joining us.